history.
Well, I guess we can start. Morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's, I guess, jump in, and I guess we'll start with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, I thank you for this gathering. Thank you for your word. Let us delight in the study this morning. And, all right. Well, I'm itching to, like, there's like a story that I want to get to, but it requires going through three chapters. That doesn't bother me, but it may bother other people. So let's just read definitely for sure 25, and then we can just see how far we get there. So any takers?
Not on that first one.
Okay. Well,
sure.
All right.
I can help with that.
Was it all Hebrew names?
Yeah.
I'm not good at that.
You just
speak
it.
I just don't.
25, yeah.
See what you signed up for?
I was like, you can't get one to three.
Thanks.
Okay, so 25, Genesis 25, it says,
yes.
Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. Now Jokshan was the father of Sheba and Dedan. The descendants of Dedan were the Asherites and the Letushites and the Lemuelites. The son of Medan were Ephah, Epher, Hanak, Abida, and Eldea. All these were descendants of Keturah. Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac, but while he was still living, he gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. Although Abraham lived 175 years, altogether Abraham lived 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man and full of years, and he was gathered to his people. His sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre, and in the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite, the field of Abraham had bought from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with his wife Sarah. After Abraham's death, God blessed his son Isaac, who then lived near Beer Lahai-Roi. This is the account of Abraham's son Ishmael, whose Sarah's maidservant Hagar the Egyptian bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael listed in the order of their birth: Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, Kedar, Adbeel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadad, Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedima. These were the sons of Ishmael, and these are the names of the 12 tribal rulers according to their settlements and camps. Altogether, Ishmael lived 137 years. He breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people. His descendants settled in the area from Havilah to Shur, near the border of Egypt, as you go toward Asher, and they lived in hostility toward all their brothers. This is the account of Abraham's son, Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel the Aramean from Padan Aram, and a sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. And after this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Esau was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man with an open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That is why he is also called Edom. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is this birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank, and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright.
Okay, so the question is, do we want to read on and see the outcome of this, which will require us to go through two more chapters, or do we want to read this one and the next one and then set up the culmination for next time? I don't care, like, this is trivial. We read the whole book.
It almost seems like there's like three or four different stories going on. That there's mm-hmm. enough in 25. Yeah.
There's a lot. Yeah.
There's a lot happening.
Yeah. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know what to say.
Well, I won't be here next week, so I'll miss it if we don't go on. But
let's burn through.
Seems like a lot, I mean, too.
Yeah, the, I think, too, there's something valuable in just reading, right?
I just want to say one point regarding this chapter.
Sure.
There are so many Christians that I talk to, you know, various topics come up out of whatever. There are so many Christians you'll meet that have no idea Abraham took another wife and had concubines.
Sure.
That some will get on their high hat about Mormons and, you know, this and that, and like everywhere in the Bible, multiple wives are condemned. I'm like, do you even know that Abraham himself had concubines and stuff? It says it right here. And God never once like condemns him for it or says anything about it.
Yeah, but
so
we see,
I just wish people would read the Bible and learn about what they're talking about and why they feel the way they do.
True, but I would say we don't see God condone it. I mean, in every instance, right, where that kind of stuff is done, you have sort of negative issues. I mean, even with Moses, right? I think, too, that is an instance of people retconning.
What's retcon?
Again, to sort of go back into a text and put anachronistic ideas into the text as though those people fought the way that we think and
right.
knew the stuff that we think.
I don't know that Moses had any concubines or multiple wives. He had one wife who was a Canaanite after his wife died.
Did she die?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Because they always referred to
him as
wife.
Oh, no, yeah, he didn't have concubines. No.
No,
I think
he basically said, God said I could. And God defended him when Miriam spoke up about it.
Yeah.
So
what's the point you're making?
The point is, in this case, right, like, because there's a sort of a new, it's not really new, right, it's been going on for a while, but there's a very... it's getting more traction in social media, a movement that is saying, oh no, it's having multiple spouses is not prohibited in Scripture, and you can be a Christian and, you know, engage in polygamy. And see, we'll look at all these, you know, look at these instances in the Old Testament. See, and of course the commentary is, yeah, sure, all kinds of things occurred in the Old Testament, but that's not an argument for why they should be done.
But is this polygamy?
Now.
Because he only has one wife.
Yeah, he's got one wife.
Everybody else is a concubine or a servant, mm-hmm. and then once his wife dies, then he takes another wife. So only one person has that first position.
But,
right,
yeah,
you still having sex with a bunch of women.
No, but I'm saying, in terms of what we define as a marriage between a husband and a wife, he only has one wife at one time.
That's
true. Then they'll look, though, at Jacob, and they'll say, oh, see, he had two,
right?
And so, again, I think Dan has said this,
before you go spend too much time on this, my point was not about whether it's right or wrong. My point was that people find something that they think is bad, and therefore any hero of scripture could not ever do that because that was bad and those heroes were good. And it's like, how you read the Bible to see what it says first. So I just want to make sure everyone knows he had concubines even though he was Abraham and God was his friend.
End. Deceitful. And what's that? How many heroes are there?
One.
Exactly.
Yeah, to people who read it.
These are just clowns.
I'm sorry. I am grateful that this church is way more scriptural studying than most churches I've been to. I'm just struggling because at Calvary Chapel there's 12,000 attendees, and I think maybe 1,000 of them actually read the Bible. So you constantly encounter people like this, and it just kind of rubs my fur the wrong way.
As I read this, I'm struck by the kind of life Abraham lived. It's not anything like ours. Nothing.
Yeah.
He's got multiple, I was about to say multiple wives, but he has all these women. I mean, he can do whatever he wants to do with them. I mean, and yet he's a righteous man. And it just strikes me how life was just, so different.
Sure, yeah, and as we'll see, there's a reason why there's a commandment given against having other gods, right? Because, again, I think it's the big issue, we cannot make the mistake of assuming that people back then knew the stuff that we know now, right? It's like going back and saying, oh, look at people who smoked back in the day. Like, they were bad, vicious, wicked, evil people because they didn't know what we know. It's like, it's ludicrous. These people aren't Christians. They don't know
don't have their Bible every night and week.
Yeah, they don't have this kind of an understanding, and so it is completely unfair. They are relating to God in the way in which God has revealed God's self to them. And yes, every single person in this room has forgotten more about God than any of these people ever knew. Like, we're in Christ, we have the Spirit, automatically, think about John the Baptist and what Jesus says about us. Like, John Baptist had nothing on any of us, like nothing. Mm-hmm. And so when we think, oh, we've got to prop these people up as though they are somehow models, they're not, right? We have one model, and that is Christ. These are people who, who came before. So,
I'm sorry. You mentioned John the Baptist, which just brought up a point that I never realized before, but just recently read for some reason. John the Baptist himself, when he testifies about Jesus, literally says, I didn't even know he was the Christ, but God told me when I started baptizing that the one whom his spirit rests on will be the Christ. And that's how, and I testify that that happened when I baptized Jesus, so I know he's the one. So isn't that amazing that he even, his cousin, he was around him, he saw him, and he's not like people just assume like, oh, I would totally know. And John the Baptist didn't know until he saw God's spirit land on him.
Sure, people who saw him do miracles didn't, right? I mean, we forget how truly blessed we are, and then we try to insert that onto these people who didn't have any of this stuff.
Can I say something a little bit more about this since we're going down this path? So, I can't remember why I was thinking about this. I mean, we did a wedding last Sunday here in the late service. And maybe it was because I was thinking about that, but so, I mean, the institution of marriage exists in the human community in some sense.
Sure.
There's like a cultural institution that's going on there. Unless you think that God gave instructions to Adam and Eve about marriage and things like that. I don't see them. You then have the law that's given, and the law does regulate marriage some. Like it tells you who you can't marry, for example. You know, and that has to do with the relations can't be too close, right? The law also, by the way, tells you that you can't. It regulates multiple wives too. Like, oh, you can't have the daughter and the mother. So even in the law of Moses, there's the assumption that there are going to be men who have more than one person sharing their bed, right? Mm-hmm. So I wrestle with the question, like, what part of our marriage right is cultural? What part of it is divine law? Or what part of it is, like, legislating a pre-existing condition? Mm-hmm. Then you have the situation, like, with Moses and the granting of divorces. Clearly not like part of God's plan, but the divorce decree is given as a way to ameliorate the problem for when the husband and wife do separate. Okay, so like husband and wife separating is not a good thing, but when it happens, this is how you make it less bad. At least you give people a legal status, because otherwise the woman is like, just like totally. And so that's also a situation where there's a kind of divine regulation, but that's coming in after the fact. There's a cultural practice, and then, okay, so let's figure this out. When I was thinking about the service last Sunday, you know, the Presbyterians have something called a book of worship, which is like a set of ordered services, like liturgies. They don't have one for, like, the 1903 doesn't have a wedding service. It's like, okay, that's kind of interesting. And I like, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't do weddings before.
That's the other thing too. Is like trying to figure out like when did they start doing the big hoopla, right?
Right.
But like you know, in the church and all. So I don't know. So I mean, you know, Melody does raise this question about like the practices we do have in the New Testament. The idea that the elders only and the deacons only supposed to be the husband of one. Right. Whether that had became normative in the Christian community. I've told this story, I think, in this place, but not in the worship service. We had an elder here, Eric Bowman. Let me remember Eric Bowman. So Eric Bowman's father-in-law is a missionary, and he works in Africa. And a number of these people that he's converting are polygamists.
Yeah.
And so I asked him, like, so what do you do about, like, the guy's got two wives or four wives? And you just leave him in place.
Yeah.
Like, not an impediment to being a Christian, but it's like, okay, and I don't, you know, that I don't know that's a biblical, I think it sounds like wisdom. The scriptures really don't speak about it.
Yeah, and I think the stuff that is done with respect to, you know, single would go to the original creation account, that it is by definition
one and
the,
one.
The totality of the image of God is encapsulated in the male and the female.
Yeah.
It's balanced. You're not having like multiple males.
Right, right, you know, right.
I mean, as some cultures would have, one female would have multiple husbands.
Right, right.
That, you know, and I think there's a certain level at which, you know, kind of makes sense. But anyway, yeah. I mean, these people, I mean, they're performing animal sacrifices, they're performing all kinds of things, some of which is prescribed by God. And again, this is just my take on it. I think always God meets us where we are. God's not going to show up and talk to us in a language that we don't speak. God's not going to ask us to engage in some sort of technological operation that we don't understand and can't understand because we lack the education to even get us to that, right? Like, God's not going to ask me to formulate some chemical compound if I don't, like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, I don't know anything, right? So
God condescends.
You stole my next, like, yes,
yeah.
I was literally about to say, God condescends to us, and it doesn't mean that God ever says, and this is, I think, important to bear in mind, God never says, you're okay where you're at. At no time does God say,
right,
you're okay where you're at, because on the contrary, we're not. But God always comes to us where we're at with the understanding we're going to be raised up, right? He comes to us as we are so that we can be in him as he is. Right? And Paul spends a good bit of energy talking about that. Again, we read through that particular lens. I guess let's do stop at least for a minute here, because I want to draw your attention to this notion of Jacob and Esau, okay, and we kind of know where the story is going to go later, but I want us to pay close attention to this. What do you make of this little interchange of Esau and Jacob and the whole birthright? I'm hungry, give me some of that red stuff. And we do need to make a distinction between birthright and blessing. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing the blessing part yet, because that's, you know, that comes up later.
I wonder about the example that he's seen before they even got to that, because he doesn't seem to take the birthright serious. Because when you look at his predecessors, when you look at what Abraham did in verse 5, he left everything he owned to Isaac.
Yep.
But he also gave gifts to the sons of his concubines.
Yep.
And sent them far away.
Yep.
And then later on, it says, as we get to the bottom, then Ishmael had his sons, and they lived in hostility towards their brothers.
Yeah.
So I guess as a child who, I'm very connected to my family history going back 200 years. I know the stories and legends about who got land, who didn't get land, who got what gifts, who was not, and the anger and the bitterness that... Oh. Even my mother and grandmother would spend time going to the lawyers to make sure that they got the land back or part of the land from my great uncle and blah, blah, blah. My mom and her siblings were like, we don't care about it. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to talk about it. And there's like, I'm like, yeah, but that's 37 acres. Do you know how much pain this has all cost everybody talking about what they're going to get, whatever. Let me just give my daily bread. And so I can easily see why somebody would be like, I'm hungry. What my inheritance is, I'll get something. I think it's about that. What was the backstory and what did he observe already? And to see your family infighting over things and stuff, that didn't seem very God art.
No. We'll be taking a look at that very kind of thing. At least when we get to the second bookend of this story. So I do at least want to draw your attention a little bit to the distinction between a birthright and a blessing. These are not the same thing. The blessing would accompany the birthright, but it's not the same thing. The birthright is more, if you want to think about it, kind of this direction, whereas the blessing is a sort of vertical, you know, kind of thing. The blessing has to do with the way in which the individual will be in relation to God and through the relationship to God to other people. The birthright has to do with your status in the family. And so if you have birthrights, I mean, we see this unpacked later in Deuteronomy where, you know, you've got the firstborn who gets the double portion. Typically, and I think our attention is always drawn to the times when it isn't this way, where it says the younger will rule over the elder, or the elder will serve the younger. The idea is that your birthright is that you now take on the mantle of the family. You're now the sort of the new patriarch. You get the double portion. And so it's, if you want to think about it, it is a legal kind of thing. It's a legal status, whereas the blessing is a more spiritual kind of religious, divine relational thing. They go together, but in other words, you don't have to have the birthright in order to get a blessing. And in some cases, as well, obviously, as we'll see, your birthright can and is stripped from you. There are other instances that we'll see in Scripture where the birthright is, in fact, stripped from somebody, in some cases based on what you did, and in other cases based on what you maybe said, as in this case. So it's fascinating to me that Esau is willing to sell his birthright for essentially a bowl of lentil. I mean, I'm sure it was tasty, but I don't know if it was that tasty. But I think it says something about his character. You know, we see later how heated he becomes. You know, I mean, the text says he despises his birthright. Later, when the next chapter of the story happens, you see how he's fuming and he's going to kill his own brother over this. Mm-hmm. Even though, this is funny to me, there's something about human nature. I come up, I do something to you, something happens to me as a result of the bad thing that happens to me, and instead of getting angry at myself, I get angry at the thing that brought the consequence to me. Like, that's the problem. You know, at no point does Esau get mad at himself for being like, oh, dude, yeah, you did that. I mean, it's not just that he's saying it casually. He says, first swear to me. So he is swearing an oath to his brother. It's not just like, yeah, sure, I'll say anything. And Jacob is also not just saying it in jest. He's saying, no, give me your birthright. And the fact that he is willing to do this, and I mean, think about it, right? I'm about to die, so of what use then is the birthright to me? Do you guys think he was about to die? Like, really? Do you really think? Like, was he actually gone? I mean, was he out there for 40 days? 49? Is he really on death's door? I mean, the dude's a hunter. Is he really on death's door? Really? I mean, really?
I have two brothers, and I just find it weird that he didn't immediately go to mom and say, Mom, I'm so hungry, and Jacob, right, is being a jerk and won't give me any of his stew. Like, is there anything in the house to eat? Like a fig cake, some honeycomb, something.
This isn't like a cluster of, you know, just these tiny few people. This is an incredibly wealthy household, tons and tons and tons of people. You could go into one of the servants' tents, for goodness sakes, and gotten something. Like, there's people everywhere. This is like a small village. And you're walking in, and your dad is the head of the village. And you're basically saying, like, oh, I'm going to die. It's like, think about it. There's zero universe in which what he is saying is actually true, right? Nobody else in the village is starving to death. Like, nobody is starving. He is also not starving. But I think what we're going to see is there's something in him that is extremely fiery. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain personalities where they're super quick to get angry, they're super quick to forget, they're super quick to laugh, they're super quick. Like, everything is just fleeting. Like, they just ride right on the caps of the waves. And there's no sense of, you know, I think, like, his prefrontal cortex has not fully developed, even though he's, like, around 40 at this time. He does not have an ability to grasp future consequences of present actions. And we see that comes back later, you know, and I actually just noticed something in the text here. I was like, oh, right. Like, it's so obvious when you see it. You're like, how did I not know this? Obviously, it makes sense.
Well, his hunger and the meals just in the background of this thing. I mean, the real story here is the birthright.
The birthright.
Sure. Oh, the giving up.
Yeah.
yeah. of his inheritance, of, of what he was, actually.
Yeah.
He says, I'm willing to give all that up, just give me some food. I mean, who can figure that out?
Why?
Yeah.
Why didn't the birthright mean more to him?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like today our wills, I think. It sounds like the birthrights, what
sure.
you have said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, write yourself out of the primary position of the will and give that to me. And he's like, yeah, yeah, sure. And he's like, no, 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 no. We're going to go down to the courthouse. We're going to sign documents.
Yep.
You write it out. Okay. Like, what? I don't need that. I'm going to die of hunger. You know, I mean, just the thought process is so comical to me.
Yeah, it is.
And then later, we see what he says about it, which is, I guess, you know, it's not spoiling because we'll come back and revisit this. He says, he took it from me. Later, he's going to say, Jacob took it from me. He took my birthright. No, you actually signed it over to him. Like, he didn't take anything.
Mm-hmm.
You signed it over. He said, hey, like, swear to me an oath. I would have just laughed at him. I mean, goodness, Esau could have just clunked him on the head. I'm like, dude, get out of the way. I'm just taking some. Like,
right.
I mean, think about it. Like, get out of the way.
True,
you know,
he
I'm
could have socked
some.
Him. And
yes.
Like...
I mean, it's ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
And so these sort of, you know, you just get the pictures painted that Esau is a very superficial, doesn't think too much about whatever he's going to do. I think he seems to be the type of person, he just opens his mouth and waits to see what's going to come out. Acts and waits to see what's going to happen. As we'll see, he doesn't obey the wishes of his parents. He does take women from, you know, the environment, the environs, flatly in contradiction to his grandfather and his wishes. And two, we see that even his anger, he's wanting to kill his own brother. When they meet again, he falls on him and embraces him. You know, it's sort of like, oh, dude, I'm like, dude, it's all good. You know, I think that's just the kind of person that he happens to be. And, but there is something extraordinary that we'll see when we get to this, to the next part of it. How many, I'm trying to think, I need to check my calendar real quick here because I need to calculate. Maybe next time, because I've only got one more. Oh yeah, we'll have to be next Sunday. Yeah, because the Sunday after that, I will. Next two Sundays, I won't be here. So, okay. So, and of course, we don't really have time to get any further into the next stuff. But I suppose if you want, we could read. In with some of the remaining time and just have this in the background. Unless there are any other thoughts on this particular chapter.
I find it interesting that the Bible gives seemingly too much detail in some stories and just not enough detail in others. And this is one of those stories, the birth of Jacob and Esau. I mean, as an adult human being that's had children, I just don't see necessarily how them fighting in her womb and one grabbing another's heel, like, really bears true significance in the rest of their lives. I don't quite understand what the Bible's trying to infer, and I see people read between the lines and come up with their own conclusions, but to me it almost seems silly. And then there's other areas in the Bible where, like, you really need to know more about this to like... Yeah, I don't know. Do you have any, let me just rephrase that. Do you have any good points to say about this seeming conflict about the children struggling in her? I mean, we know nations fight against each other all the time. I mean, even peaceable nations, like the United States and Canada, we're fighting with each other now. Like, it's so easy for a group of people to become upset with another group of people. So I don't fully understand what the Bible's trying to get at here. I mean... Maybe it's because we grow up in a time where we're aware of global news and we know that nations have been fighting against nations since longer than we've been alive, but...
So are you asking about the children struggling in her womb?
Yes.
And the significance of that? Oh, Well, yeah, in this case, it's not an issue of warring, right? That is something that we see when God essentially simultaneously gives this blessing, right? Because God, and actually, that's interesting. So when God tells Abraham that the child of his body is going to be blessed, etc., I'm going to make a great nation of you, etc., he doesn't rescind that with respect to Ishmael, right? It's like, I am granting this to you so that whatever comes out of you is going to have this capacity, and you went on your own and did something contrary to what I told you, but I'm not taking back the thing that I said. So yes, Ishmael is going to be a great nation. It's not according to my terms, but hey, you went and you did you, and now this is what happens. But I'm not, you know, God doesn't say a thing and then say, oh, you know, it only counts when it's under circumstances that are to that particular end. And so and in that he does say, you know, he will, every man's hand will be against him, and he will be, his hand will be against every man. And then you see right here where he visits that, like, yeah, like they were at war with everybody around them.
Right.
And it's just sort of this little nod, and you're thinking, why would it say that? Until you go back and remember, oh yeah, well, it said that that would happen. And in this case, you see this idea of struggle, but they're not necessarily fighting, although you do see some, you know, conflicts with respect to their children. Now, when it comes to the idea of, like, the one is hanging on to the other one, you know, maybe there is a reading into of things in terms of their significance, and it's possible. Like, I do see this. You know, I do see that in the modern mind, because I see it with my students, and I see it by generation. When I was first teaching, a couple of years ago, when I was first started teaching, I could give my students texts to read where you had to tease out subtle nuance. And they had a capacity to do that that students today simply don't have. I mean, adults don't have. I mean, there are instances where I'm seeing, even in biblical scholarship today, this almost, for lack of a better word, it's an almost autistic way of reading. You're really good at mechanically parsing out, this says this and this and this, and it's like, okay, that's cool, but you don't seem to actually be able to read what it means. Like,
read
there's like nuance in there and subtlety that you can't grasp for some reason, and I don't know why that is. And I think that maybe when, because of our, you know, we have all this technology, we're very sort of science-based, there's nothing against science, you know, yay, hooray for science. But I think what it can do to us is make us, almost in the way that a person who loses a sense becomes more tuned to subtle nuances, I think that there's subtlety in this that is being perceived, where we're just like, oh, I'm just like, who cares, like babies grab, like babies grab, right? You put something in a baby, you know, babies will grab at things. Okay, so one kid is hanging on to the other kid. I mean, it's a baby. Is the baby like thinking like, oh, I'm going to get you. I need to be first, right? I don't think that that's what these babies are doing. And I don't think the text is implying that these babies were like, no, I'm going to be first out. I think it's just drawing attention to, this is something that's just sort of in their nature for this to take place, right? Again, that's about as far as I would ever, you know, make anything. Because otherwise you're almost doing this sock puppet thing, which I absolutely despise, where people will have like almost God sock puppeting people to make them do things. It's like, I need you to do something, so and then God sock puppets the other person and has them just have engaged in this sort of pantomime, which is meaningless and kind of silly. momentarily just to make some point in a story, and then God walks away and is like, well, I needed to do that just to set that up for later people. I just think that somebody somewhere is making an observation that isn't it ironic that even in the case of them being born, like the one is grabbing hold of the other. But when she inquires of the Lord, that's the important thing. Like, he just simply says, okay, like, you're feeling two kids, you know, kicking around in each other, which is perfectly normal, you know, when you have twins or whatever, even when you don't, like, they're kicking around and stuff. But I'm simply telling you that this is what is going to happen, you know, again, like, a little infant is not, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, but the whole thing about it happening, other people realize it because it says that's why his name was what it was.
Mm-hmm.
They actually named him because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was something that was noticed and thought about. And
yes, and two, unlike today, like today we have names picked out,
yeah,
prefabbed, ready to go. That's not necessarily how it was. I mean,
right,
sometimes you would, and I think too, like the Bible will tell you, you're going to name your kid this in advance. That's not normal. Usually you would have a kid and you would kind of look at the kid and say, like, well, what are we going to call the kid? I mean, you know, probably these are human beings, so maybe, I'm sure people had ideas for names, but so many of the times the name of the child would have something to do with the circumstances of his birth, right? It's like, you can't pick that out.
Well, that's obviously what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, there are other instances, and we've already seen instances where, later we're going to see where something happens. My child is born, so I name the child this, right? I'll name my child Laughter in this case because whatever. I name my child, you know, Weeping or something like that because when I gave birth, that's what it was. But yeah, this idea that where we pre-select and like, oh, I've had a name in my mind for, you know, from Annie's already got names picked out, you know, for her kids. Yeah, it's like, okay, well, I mean, that's cool. Nothing wrong with that. But
I've seen it both ways.
Yeah.
Like people, some cultures, they're very much like, wait till the weekend, see the baby's personality,
yeah.
Give them a name.
Yes.
And then some people have a prophetic where it's like, no, this is the name.
Sure.
For I know for myself, I had a specific name picked out for if I had a daughter ever.
Yep.
I knew what I was going to name her.
Yep.
And then 6 months before I gave birth, I literally had a vivid dream. And in my dream, there was something happening. And I started calling to my daughter. It was a whole different name.
Oh, really?
And it shook me. I woke up and I was like, okay. I told my husband, I said, I think it's the name. He was like, I like that name. We couldn't agree on another name. I told him that name. He said, yeah, that's the name.
Yeah.
And so that became her name.
Sure.
And then I ended up having a second girl. And she got the name that I always thought that I was going to have a girl.
Yeah, I mean, my name, I know what my name would have been if I'd have been a girl. It's Heidi.
Oh.
That's my girl name. But yeah, like in many other cultures too, it's like you would never presume to name a child. There would be different kinds of omens that would surround, and you would deliberately wait to see what is this kid's name going to be. So again, it's like, you know, the idea of them fussing and fighting and things. I don't think that there's too much to be read into that, but I also don't think it's just some sort of maudlin kind of, I don't know, like.
I mean, could it be an affirmation? Because
because
she already asked of the Lord, like
yes,
you said
and
earlier.
Again, to me, it's like if nothing happened, if there was zero drama when they were born,
right?
Like it's the important thing is that God says this is what's going to happen, and this is because this, and this is something that I personally glossed over. I'm like, yeah, whatever, I know the story. And I glossed over it my whole life, and I just noticed something. I'm like, oh, okay, that explains something that I never noticed. I think I should have known better. And it's so obvious now in retrospect, like I can't unsee it. But it has nothing to do with the twin, like the one kid grabbing the other kid's heel. I mean, you know, whatever. As we see other instances where you know, somebody puts their hand out, you wrap a string around it, that's the first one, and then the other one pops out, and it's like, you know. But like in that culture, it was extremely important to know which one came out. If there's more, like, it's really important because you, in that mindset, as we'll see, it actually is really, really important to know which one of these is first. Because if you get it wrong, and it's also very important to ensure that somebody's tracking who's coming out in what order, and you have witnesses being born to this so that there's no confusion. We're, I think, a lot more kind of like, what's the big deal? For them, that was a very, very big deal. So, anyway, well, we're out of time. I will pray us out. Dear Lord, thank you again for my brothers and sisters. Thank you for your word and the delight we have in digging in it. Be with us in the days and weeks to come, and let us do all things to your glory. In the name of your Son, Christ, we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, friends, again, so next week will be my last week for, and I'm off to Greece. So
oh, my goodness.
Already.
So nice.
Yeah.
So, what are you going to do in Greece?
As much and as little as possible.
A vacation?
No, I'm leaving a tour with our university.
Nice.
So, study abroad. What's that?
I can't believe you came already.
Yeah.
They're doing like a biblical tour?
No. It's just a study abroad with EF Tours.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah, then we're doing a cruise, so, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Must be nice, huh?
Yeah, it's...
Get to go with all this stuff.
Yeah.